Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Scottish Clans. I'm Clint. Thank you for spending this time with me. Welcome to part two of my discussion with Dr. Martin McGregor. I'm excited to share this part with you. If you didn't listen to the first part, you may want to go back and listen to the previous episode, because in that episode, Dr. McGregor talks about the origins and rise of both the Campbells and the McGregors. And right where I split the discussion to make the two parts was right where he's talking about how these two clans start, their relationship starts to come together. They merge. He gives a hypothesis about how these clans became connected to each other, not just geographically, but possibly by kinship through marriage. So go back and check out all the wonderful content that he shared with us in the previous episode. But if you already listened to this, then I'm excited to share this one with you. I'm picking it up exactly where we left off on the previous one. Before I turn you over to the rest of my discussion with Martin McGregor, I just want to remind you to go over and check out my YouTube channel. Now, if you're listening to this really quick after I publish it, I won't have it up there on the YouTube channel yet, but not very long in the future. And I think I've been faithful to my word when I say not very long or very soon, because I just barely published part one of this conversation, and I told you part two was coming soon, and so I think this qualifies as soon after. So soon, in the near future, I will have bits and pieces of this conversation broken up and having visual aids attached to the discussion, especially for those of you who don't have a map of Scotland memorized in your head, for those of you who don't know what these different locations look like. I'll include some of those things that are just helpful when you're learning history, and I'll put them over on YouTube. I've already done that with other episodes that I've done. I've also published some content that is not brought from the podcast with visual aids added and then posted on YouTube. Some of it I just made for YouTube. So go over and check that out. If you want to visit my website at scottish-clans.com, if you want some access to some free resources, I've posted a few things on there, so check that out. There's a link under, well, you can either click on that main page or you can go to scottish-clans.com/team if you want to contribute to the effort here. All of this takes time. Usually away from my family and some resources that I need access to, some subscriptions, some sources, things like that. So if you want to contribute to the cause, go over there. But if you're like me and you love podcasts because they're free, that's cool too. There's a few free things that you can do to support the channel. Don't cost you a dime. You can follow this on whatever platform that you're listening to it on. You can share it with somebody who you think would enjoy this, especially if you know that either their last name is Campbell or McGregor, or you know they have them in their ancestry. I know people in both categories, people who I'm very good friends with some Campbells back in Idaho. I'm a little shout out to them. Love those guys. I'm also know a family of McGregors who are wonderful, wonderful human beings back in the same community back in Idaho, Campbells and McGregors. So, but I also know other people who are, that's not their surname, but they do have these families in their ancestry. A shout out to Dane Sawyer, who is a very good friend. I've even mentioned him by name on previous episodes. Very good friend of mine. I know for a fact that he has McGregor ancestry. In fact, we do mention it during this conversation with Dr. McGregor, how some of the Campbells, after they became outlawed and had to change their names, some of them adopted the surname of Gregory. And I believe that Dane's, that's where his branch comes from, is one of those who changed their name to that and distinguish them in some of the more intellectual fields. So yes, there's a few things you can do is share this with people that you know would like this, would be interested in it, or people who are just not, they have no ties to Campbell or McGregor. They just are interested in this, but they don't know about this yet because I'm not a great marketer. But if we spread this by word of mouth, it can get to the right people. So share it with them. Comment on it. Send me an email if you have something more specific you want to discuss. thescottishclans@gmail.com. You can also go over to the Facebook group, and we have some great conversations are on the Scottish Clans Facebook group. So without any further ado, I will turn you over to the rest of my discussion with Dr. Martin McGregor. And so you have that to me speaks to the adaptability of this kin-based society as it comes off. It looks like clear as early as Dalriada, we have, you know, with the different Canela, these different kin groups, but as time goes on and political situations change and it just adapts and forms to this, you know, feudalism for sure had a clear impact on this world, but it continued, it adapted, it absorbed it and continued forward. And that's amazing to me.
I would entirely agree. You know, I think Gaelic society in Scotland is just a remarkable thing to study. You know, I mean, I'm really lucky to be in the field. And you're right, you know, there is this, on the face of it, you know, historians, I think, are always a bit suspicious about continuity, and especially about, you know, continuities across centuries. But I think we do have here a society which is essentially, you know, takes kinship as its big thing, and it kind of goes through various phases of that. You know, the terminology may change, and, you know, I don't think we can ever, as historians, think, well, it's only the name that's changing. You're always saying to yourself, there must be other things changing too. And you talk quite rightly about political structures, you know, across this period. Scotland itself, you know, which wasn't there in the first place, is now there as a kingdom. And as I said, it's got a legal code to which all the subjects of the king are bound. So, you know, clan society is a product of this, and it's having to adapt to this. And this, I think this makes for really kind of fascinating study from an historian's point of view. And I guess, you know, it's perhaps easy for us to, you know, maybe this is the easiest way of conceptualizing, is to think of the kind of the feudal, if you want, or the kind of legal side of things on the one hand, the landowning setup, and then the kin-based aspect as well, and just to try and think how these two things get along together and influence each other. But that's perhaps our way of seeing things, of course. You know, modern, you know, we're on the outside and separated from this by a long way. And perhaps for those at the time, you know, it would have been much more organic than that. And they might not have really thought in terms of these, you know, sort of separate spheres, as it were. For them, it was, you know, an integrated existence that they were living.
Yeah. And then to put names and faces on that, so you have, they gain ownership. So legal title to an area is different than power, right? Yeah. And so they gain Glenorchy, yet on the ground. And it would take a few generations for the Campbells of Glenorchy to actually be a kin-based presence in that area. So they develop these relationships with the kindreds who are there. And I guess after time, the Glenorchy, the clan, whatever clan, you can think about this on the broader picture, they come into a new area, new territory like Glenorchy, and they would kind of grow down into that with marriages. And because I often think about my own, specifically my mother's side of the family. Her last name is Corbridge. And we have not very many generations. We have a big reunion. They were a cattle family, and with a ranch up a little ways north of here, back up in Idaho, and they have a reunion there every year. And it's amazing, just because I was just barely, like, the distance in generation between me and Lawrence or LG Corbridge and Mary Tuttle Corbridge, and they're like, a lot of people that knew them are still alive. Like, it's not a very far gap, I guess, is my point. Yet they had a lot of kids, and man, there are a lot of descendants. So it doesn't take very many generations to really get up and going as a clan. But they, now if I going back to the Campbells and McGregor, I just use that as a thought in my head to, like, pretty quick, you can have a pretty numerous posterity in an area. So they, the Campbells of Glenorchy, if I understood your thesis, and I feel free to adjust my understanding of this, that the McGregors were kind of like the tip of the spear in expanding into new territories, as we get to describe the relationship between these two clans.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is right. And just to go back to your point there, I mean, I think that's an excellent analogy. And there's no doubt that within a clan-based society, clans, and this is one thing that really comes across, is that the speed with which clans can be born, if you like, come into being and grow, and especially when it's taken into account in late medieval Scotland, you might be married to one particular woman, but there might be other potential partners as well. There was some fluidity within that scene, and that could allow for even more rapid growth. And there's some quite remarkable statistics coming from Ireland. We've got a similar kind of clan society, and where we've got better genealogical documentation, there's some really remarkable statistics about how rapidly a clan could multiply. But it's clearly the same on the Scottish side. So the MacGregors are obviously, they've been around for a while. They're more substantial just in terms of the pure numbers game. I think it's interesting to note as well that because they had been the top people, it's not as if the Campbells come in and seek to strip that away from them, or come in suspicious of them and seeking to, kind of keep them down, see them as a potential threat. It's almost the reverse, that the Campbells acknowledge. It's all about acknowledging the legitimacy of that MacGregor position. Now, okay, they've gone down a notch in terms of the landholding structure, but various forms of compensation seem to be built into the relationship from the start, just to acknowledge the importance of the MacGregors. For one thing, the main fortress of the Campbells of Glenorchy at this time, and the castle of Kilchearn at the top end of Loughaw, the north end of Loughaw, which is still there to this day. Now, it was a MacGregor family that were the castle keepers there. Now, that's a classic kind of structure to indicate that we've got here a kindred which is okay, subordinate in a sense, but which is being given particular status.
Almost
And
similar to the way that the McCrays were for the Mackenzies with Ellen Donan.
that's exactly the same kind of thing. This seemed to be one of the ways to kind of give that. And also, there's the fact that we know from slightly later sources that the MacGregor chief, he could act as steward, or appoint somebody else to be steward of his own lands within the Lordship of Glenorchy. So he had a degree of autonomy over his own territory. And then the third thing one can say, coming back to your point there, is that the MacGregors become this kindred which can act on behalf of the Campbells. So we've got that sense of collaboration here, that they have a role in the scheme of things. And this was sort of what seemed to occur to me, to come out of the evidence to me as I looked at it, Clint, as you trace the fact that over the 15th and 16th centuries, both the Campbells of Glenorchy and the MacGregors expand from Glenorchy. They expand eastwards, taking advantage of propitious circumstances, and it looks as if the MacGregors are kind of acting almost as the kind of the pioneers, the clearers of the trail, and they establish themselves on the ground, and then the Campbells of Glenorchy can follow suit. But usually, in their case, that means that they're also gaining title to the lands concerned. So it really does look like a pretty impressive exercise in collaborative expansion. And that means that by the early 16th century, kind of fast forwarding for a century or so, we find them really with their centre of gravity having shifted quite a lot now geographically, that the Loch Tay area, Highland Perthshire, the central highlands of Scotland, that's really where the Campbells of Glenorchy are kind of mainly based now, and the MacGregors are there and thick on the ground as well. So it's kind of fascinating for me to just to observe this expansion pattern, and the fact that it was being done clearly on a collaborative basis as well, that where the MacGregors went inevitably, because they were so tied to the Campbells, Campbell authority and sometimes Campbell settlement and Campbell title, etc., would follow.
So there was a long history of cooperation before this effort to exterminate him completely, and we'll get to that in a second. I just want to make sure I'm following with this expansion. I think it's really interesting you talk about the center of gravity for the Campbells of Glenorchy shifts to the Loch Tay area. Did the because so now we see the development also of branches of the MacGregors. We started off real early talking about the ones that established in Perth, but as we go reset on the timeline and continue down, we see the MacGregors established in Glen Lyon, and then also in Glen Gyle. And if I'm not mistaken, it's Rob Roy is coming out of Glen Gyle. Is that correct?
That's
Are those
correct.
branches, are the Glen Lyon and Glen Gyle MacGregors, are they established? So two questions. Are they established at this time period? And maybe throw out a kind of a rough date that we're playing around with at this when this is happening. And then also, does their center of gravity shift? Because if I remember correctly, their chief is still of Glen Strae, or styled of Glen Strae. Does that mean that he's still geographically located, or has he shifted too, but he still uses that as a style? How does that all come together?
Yeah, these are really good good questions. And I mean, just to think of our chronology here, I mean, you mentioned Glen Lyon, and that's a kind of major. I was there not long ago, and it's often called, I think, it is the longest glen in Scotland, kind of very much in the centre of the
Wow.
Highland. Absolutely beautiful glen, extending essentially in a kind of east-west axis, and for centuries it's been a major conduit. This was true in the various monks who kind of followed on from Columba himself were spreading Christianity in Scotland, in the way back in the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries, that period, the kind of great age of the saints. And that was there was a clearly a kind of Iona, an axis that took you all the way from Iona right across through places like Glen Lyon across to eastern Scotland. So that looks like it was the main route by which the MacGregors came from the Gonorchy area eastwards and down to Loch Tay. The mouth of Glen Lyon kind of takes you right down to Loch Tay side. So this was in the later 15th century that was happening. Glen Gyle, I think, and the expansion of the MacGregors southwards down to the area that we talked about at the start of things, the Lennox, that's happening. Perhaps slightly later development, maybe taking us into the 16th century. But as you say, Rob Roy comes off these people. They're often forming mini clans as they go. This is the classic pattern. The MacGregors are doing this as well. And the Glen Gyle MacGregors, they seem to use the style, the surname, as it were, their subsidiary surname of MacRoberst or Mac, son of Robert. So that was a favoured name on their part, and Rob Roy is kind of part of that. But it's a really interesting point you make about the MacGregor chiefs. They remain effectively anchored where they were in the heartland, in Glenorchy, in particular the lands of Glen Strae, which is within the lordship of Glenorchy. That had become their bit of that lordship when they have to, as it were, accommodate a Campbell presence on the ground as well. And MacGregor chiefs, we know, are buried in the graveyard at the church of at the, in the small village of Dalmally in that part of the world. So that seems to remain a kind of heartland for the MacGregors, a kind of spiritual centre, if you like, and the main place of residence of their chiefs. We always have to remember that chiefship was a pretty a mobile thing in this period, and that if you were the head of a clan, you needed to get around and be seen. This was true, of course, of lordship in general. There was no point in being stuck in one place. The personal presence was a crucial aspect of this. But that didn't mean that the MacGregor chief upped sticks entirely and moved eastwards. And that seems to be different, interestingly, as far as the Campbells of Glenorchy were concerned, because they've still got that big fortress of Kilhearn that we mentioned at the top end of Loch Awe. That's obviously, as it were, their kind of main first fortress. But by the 16th century, they're spending much more of their time in their fortresses at either end of Loch Tay, at Killin at one end. This is the castle of Finnlarig, and then at the other end, they develop a castle at a place called Balloch or Bealach in Gaelic, which becomes known in English as Taymouth. This is where the Tay leaves Loch Tay and makes its descent down to Perth, the river Tay. Yeah, so I think that's interesting. I think this displays the two aspects, if you like, of both the ability to expand and to take in new territory, but also that sense of connection to heartland. And there's no doubt that Glen Strae is the very much the kind of heartland for the MacGregor chiefs, and it becomes ultimately the perhaps the key bone of contention when the relationship between Campbells and MacGregors turns sour.
Which is a great lead into you have this wonderful collaborative effort that seems to be really working well for both of them as they expand. And that helps me understand really well the dynamic going on. So the center of gravity shifts for Campbell of Glenorchy, but not so much for McGregor of Glenstrae yet. Like you said, so he's moving around. He's still visiting these various branches of his own clan, and they still maintain this cohesiveness, which you do see as you progress in history. There's still a McGregor entity, despite the Campbells and the central government's best efforts. So where did it all go south between the Campbells and the McGregors?
Yeah, this is the big question. Give me one second. I'll just check that my battery is still going fine.
Okay. I actually just had some relatives, some of my wife's family show up too. So we'll edit all this out. We'll maybe talk about, and I don't even know if it's well defined, but the split between the Campbells, or this contentious element that it arrives here. And then I'll let you commence with your day. I'm sure you've got. By the way, I am really enjoying this. I am probably going to watch. This is going to be good for me to go back over several times, because there's just so much rich stuff that is not presented in the regular run of things. So this is awesome. I'm really enjoying this.
Likewise. Yeah.
Okay. So Martin, where did it all go south? I don't even know if we have all the details to this, or if it's just theoretical, or speculative, but what do you think?
Well, I think the evidence is not bad at all, actually. And I think the first thing I would say is that, there is nothing to say that a clan is going to remain in an upwards trajectory forever. The Campbells as a whole may manage this trick somehow, but one sees blips on the path, and, sub-branches themselves, or branches rather of the kindred, can have their ups and downs. And this happened to the Campbells of Glenorchy in the first half of the 16th century. And it looks like a significant watershed here was the Battle of Flodden, actually. You know, this was 1513, one of the major battles in Scottish history, and a very, very significant defeat. James IV of Scotland took an army over the border, and they came to grief in Northumberland. And the casualties were very heavy. And this was kind of unusual in medieval and late medieval times, that you would lose so many of your top people. But the king died, and many of his chief nobility died around him. Now, the Campbells suffered grievously at the Battle of Flodden. The Earl of Argyll was killed. This was the second Earl. And the second chief of the Campbells of Glenorchy was killed beside him. And we don't know how many of their followers were killed as well, but one suspects that the casualties were significant. And the Campbells of Glenorchy really took a hit with Flodden. I think it's in the wake of that we see just a period of really significant uncertainty. We can't cite chapter and verse in terms of the qualities of the chiefs who come in, but chiefs numbers 3, 4, and 5 really don't seem to kind of cut it, if you like. They don't seem to be at that level of capability that numbers 1 and 2 had down to 1513. Now, in a situation like this, you become vulnerable very fast, and the Campbells, whereas the Earls of Argyll had enjoyed a close relationship with the Campbells of Glenorchy down to 1513, that seems to shift, and we have a new rising kindred within the Campbell Confederation. These are the Campbells of Cawdor, or Calder, in the northeast of Scotland. Again, interesting, because they are, right on the kind of Lowland Highland frontier country, going back to what we were saying earlier. So they seem to be kind of garnering attention, having a close relationship with the overall Campbell chiefs, the Earls of Argyll. And then perhaps Even more interestingly or worryingly for the Campbells of Glenorchy, they, by this time, in the classic pattern, they had spawned two clans of their own in the Lough Tay area in Highland Perthshire. The Campbells of Glenlyon, already mentioned, the Glenlyon, and then the Campbells of Lors as well. And one sees these branches, rather than perhaps kind of looking to support the main line, which is in trouble, potentially becoming rivals to it. There seems to be a real possibility that the Campbells of Glenorchy could have gone down in the first half of the 16th century, perhaps been swallowed up by, as it were, their children, their own progeny. This is the kind of really sort of brutal side of a clan-based society. And through this period, the MacGregors don't seem to have been suffering in the same way. And I think what happens, therefore, is that the MacGregors, but perhaps the question of their subsidiarity to the Campbells of Glenorchy perhaps becomes into question, and the relationship between the two, perhaps people begin to look at that in a different light. So I think that's the kind of background. There is this instability for the Campbells of Glenorchy, and then in 1550, and this is one of those places where in history we do seem to encounter a genuine watershed. 1513 in Flodden, I think, is another one as well. But then we get the accession of the sixth chief of the Campbells of Glenorchy, an individual called Grey Colin Campbell in Gaelic. This is just an English translation of his proper Gaelic name, Cailín Lia. And he comes in, and all the evidence suggests that he was conscious of this recent history and was going to do everything in his power and exploit every conceivable avenue available to reverse this period of decline. And it looks like he put the kind of front and center of his policy a shift in the relationship with the MacGregors, not just to kind of put them back to where they had been, but to actually make their subordination a much more explicit one than had previously been the case.
Wow. I have in my head now, I'm going way off the path here, like as far as the historical record. My imagination is kicking in as you describe this. I picture an interaction between a representative of the Campbells of Glenorchy, either the representative himself or somebody very close to him, talking to somebody similar on the MacGregor side, and this weakness that has happened to the Glenorchys, less subtle, more right out on the table, with the MacGregor possibly saying, "Well, what if we just take this military strength that we've been using for you this whole time?" And like there's some things said, and like explosion, and like, you know what? You're all done.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dynamics of this are really dramatic to think about, and you're quite right to refer to that point that the MacGregors. I mean, we didn't say too much about how that expansion actually happened, and it can be difficult to kind of get evidence of that. You think about a clan society and how are they doing this? Are they just essentially killing all those in their path as they expand eastwards? I don't think so. I think a lot of the time it's simply to do with sheer kin power and the kind of occupation of territory, almost like squatting, as it were, kind of moving in if you can into territory, and basically saying to others, well, if you're going to shift me out, then you're going to have to, kind of do that by forcible means. We do actually have good evidence as to how this happened in Rannoch, which is kind of north of Lough Tay, and an area where the MacGregors, which they really effectively colonised in the first part of the 16th century. And it doesn't look like there was much in the way of actual, violence, in terms of, there was no great dramatic battle which enabled them to get hold of Rannoch. They exploited a vacuum of power on the ground. They moved in, and nobody was capable of moving them out. So it was, kind of, this is not the kind of dramatic kind of action that one would perhaps like to associate with the clans, but I suspect a lot of the time this was the kind of reality of it. But
Now
this
they
is the
did
MacGregor's
try,
faction.
right? They did try to get him
He
out.
did.
Like w there
He
was
did.
a was it the you said you used the Gaelic pronunciation, like on the record it looks like Menzies, but you used the Gaelic for it earlier, and
Yeah, well, Mingus is what we say in Scots,
Mingus.
or you sometimes you'll hear Menzies, but in Gaelic, it's you call the Minguses collectively Naméinearaigh, Naméinearaigh. So that's kind of, I mean, their name goes back to France, of course, as we were saying earlier, but it passes into,
Yes.
or it gets Gallicized.
They had lordship of that area of Rannoch Moor, didn't they? And they e even if the McGregors didn't use violence getting in, man, they were really hard to root out once they were there, and the Mingus wanted to, didn't they?
This is right. It is really a classic case study of how expansion takes place within a clan-based society. And I think the crown was partly at fault here, it has to be said, in that there was a local lineage which had Rannoch, and these were a branch of the Stuarts, in fact. And James IV essentially supplanted them, brought in one of the Minguses who was promising that he would pay a significantly higher rent, and of course that meant that the Stuarts responded. There was violence here, all right. They did not take kindly to this, especially because they regarded themselves as much more powerful locally than the Minguses were, which is quite true. And so they responded by, and this is right at the start of the 16th century, by raising the Mingus fortress, the local Mingus fortress, to the ground. So there was, kind of an act of extreme violence there. But the crown continued in its path of backing the Minguses. The Minguses really struggled to assert themselves in Rannoch. They tried to get support from others to do so. The upshot was that a vacuum was created into which the MacGregors were expanding in the area anyway. This was just a perfect opportunity within a clan-based society. For a clan like theirs. And it's one of the signs, this is in the around about 1520 or so, that the MacGregors make their major move into Rannoch. As you rightly say, attempts are made to get them out. The Earl of Athol is one agent of the crown, or somebody who makes an attempt, but it's really, really difficult. If you've got a powerful clan like that that moves in, and there's not really kind of recognized authority in the ground has already been significantly disrupted. Then it's really hard to do anything about that, I think. And they establish themselves there, and what happens subsequently, of course, is that that allows the Campbells to extend their influence in that part of the world, according to the classic way that that relationship had worked. So that was the Campbells. So that was the MacGregors continuing in this vein of expansion. And this is, I think, another reason as to why Gray Colin Caelan Lea, when he comes in 1550, that he is he just looks at this relationship and thinks, I've got to do something about this. I'm just not going to allow a clan of this degree of military power to operate anymore.
And
It
so
is.
he pushes forward with a policy of let's get rid of them all together. I don't know if I have not studied this to the degree that you have. I did watch some show. It was a documentary, but I don't remember who did it or whatever, but I just remember the thing that, because I've got a vivid imagination, as I was mentioning earlier, that possible interchange that I just completely made up in my head, but this really stuck with me probably because I could see it in my head. But that there's this the Campbells of Glenorchy had big black dogs that they trained to sniff MacGregors out, and they're just trying to basically exterminate the MacGregors. And this is before 16, the Battle of Glenfruin, before all that, that they're really trying to take him out. First of all, is there any truth to the dog thing? And second of all, what were they doing to try to really squash the MacGregors?
Yeah, on the dogs, I'm not sure. It's perfectly possible, I guess. I mean, one just needs to be careful. It's conceivable that some elements, in the story are kind of developed, which just dramatize it,
Sure.
and take it too far. So hard to say on that one. But in terms of what Caelan Lea, Gray Colin does, I mean, initially the tactics are. They're I think they're tactically very sound, really, if you're setting out with the objective that he had to really bring this kindred to heel, in that he strikes when they're vulnerable. We've already talked about this principle as being the way to do it in a clan-based society. You know, if the ruling lineage of a clan is weakened for any reason, then that's a time to strike. And in the case of the MacGregors, what happens in the early 1550s is that the then chief, we're told by the source in question, and it's you know, kind of not really kind of committing itself, it just says that he died of the hurt of an arrow when he was going between Glenlyon and Drannoch. So you're kind of left to guess at what this means. You know, is this actually some kind of accident, or is it a political assassination? Who knows? I mean, given what happened subsequently, you wouldn't rule out foul play in this situation. But he leaves a brother behind who is now going to succeed as the chief of the MacGregors, and he is underage, and he doesn't attain his majority, come into his, you know, age when he would be able to inherit land, etc., until 1562. So you've got a vulnerability there, and then this takes us back a few years. Grey Colin in 1552, this is probably in the wake of this death of the then MacGregor chief. He makes bonds with a number of MacGregor groups, kin groups, whereby they accept him as their chief and renounce their own. So that probably is happening, I think, in the wake of the death of this individual, the then MacGregor chief. You know, it looks like there's this vulnerability suddenly has come to the MacGregors. And then in 1554, Grey Colin, Carling Lia, he makes a really significant move in terms of the landholding situation, in that he himself buys the superiority of the MacGregor lands within the Lordship of Glenorchy. So the lands that the chief has held all the way through, we could say, the real heartland of the clan, he buys that superiority from the Earl of Argyll. So he is now the feudal superior, if you like, of that MacGregor chief. He will be subordinate to him when he comes of age. And when that time comes, and this is late 1562, and this is the MacGregor chief, Gregor Roy in English, Gregor Ruaidh in Gaelic, Roy or Ruaidh signifying the colour red, usually applied to hair. He comes into his majority, so you would expect now to have the right to be given legal possession of the lands of Glenstrae. But Carling Lia says you're only going to get these lands if you accept certain restrictions, which are, we're not told what these were going to be, legal restrictions, but he's also told you're only going to get these if you surrender two of your dependents to me. These were dependents who had, it was alleged, recently been involved in the killing of one of Carling Lia's own servants. So this was clearly, and a time scale is set, a deadline is set, the 1st of January. This is 24th of November is this document whereby Carling Lia says, you know, I'm going to give you the lands, but on these conditions. And the 1st of January is the deadline for handing over these two dependents. So you can, I think, clearly see what's happening here, that this is a really naked attempt to bring this MacGregor chief, you know, at the outset of his chiefship, into a position of complete subordination. And of course, the fact was that if he surrendered these dependents, he was betraying one of the basic principles of chiefship, that you know, you ought to protect those of your clan. So this was the, you know, a really difficult situation for this young chief to be placed in, right at the start of his chiefship.
And
It's
so,
threatened to kind of nullify his chiefship before it had even begun.
right. I do think that's a really interesting concept to this is an example of that demonstrates this concept of chiefship. And just like we say, the Campbells were a Highland clan that were got really good at operating in the lowlands. They didn't forget how Highland things worked, and they sure didn't forget. It looks like a deliberate strike at him, like you were saying, and his ability to look out for the clan. So he's weakening his leadership of his own kindred. And then, and did I catch that you said that in he's also trying to get subordinate, like some of the gentry of Clan Gregor, to like through a bond? Was that the mechanism that he's using here to accept him as their chief, which was a thing. They didn't, even though there's no biological connection, they could accept him as their chief, yeah?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and that went back a few years earlier. And this could happen. And we know that it happened in the case of other kindreds, actually. The MacLarens, the Hooder, slightly south of Lough Tay, moving south before you get to the Lennox. They were a clan who were subordinate to the Campbells, to the point where their own chief had limited authority, and they would accept the head of the Campbells, whether it was the Earl of Argyll or the Campbells of Glenorchy, as their own chief. In fact, the service of this clan was passed from Argyll to Glenorchy in this period. And there's the MacIntyres of Lorne, another clan further to the west. And in the 15th century, one of their number killed a foster brother of the first of the chief of the Campbells of Glenorchy. And this was a really fatal mistake to make, because the bond of fosterage was very, very, kind of highly valued within Gaelic society. And in order to save themselves from what I think in this case would have been, decimation, they had to hand over the perpetrator or perpetrators. And in doing that, of course, their chief was effectively nullifying his own existence. And thereafter, the MacIntyres of Lorne look to the Campbells of Glenorchy as providing their chief. So we're in a kind of similar world, I think, when it comes to the MacGregors in 1562, that we're thinking along the same lines of just making this chiefship an empty vessel, effectively. So that's the dilemma facing the young chief. What do I do? Do I accept these conditions, or do I make a stand against them?
That's really, and thank you for including those other examples from the MacLarens, the MacIntyres. And so we have this antagonistic relationship that develops between the Campbells of Glenorchy and the MacGregors. Now I'm gonna push way forward. To what extent do we see Campbell mechanism? Because let me back up a little bit. I've always been fascinated with the Battle of Salk. And you have this marriage party, and they only got to make it 180 yards from the castle to the chapel to have this union sealed. Then that makes his son legitimate, and he can inherit, he can move forward, and you have an ambush in that 180 yards. But as you zoom out, you've got some MacDougall stuff going on. They've recruited some MacFarlanes to come in, and you're like, what are MacFarlanes doing way up here? But then you also have the Stewarts of Appin, who are the ones that got ambushed, but they're close. Well, the wife in this union is a MacLaren, as I read more on this battle, that's so fascinating to me. You see, the Earl of Argyll is kind of like a puppet master back here. Was there anything like that going on with the proscription or the outlawing of the Clan Gregor?
Coming right down to 1603. Yeah, I mean, I think I have to confess, Clint, that my knowledge of this period, is poorer, because my work and my thesis really didn't get me beyond 1570.
Gotcha.
What I did do certainly was to look beyond that in the case of the Campbells of Glenorchy and the nature of the lordship that they created after 1550, because that became a matter of great interest to me. Not just Gray Colin Canine Lea, but his son, Black Duncan Donoghadhu, after him. Between them, the chiefship of these two men takes us from 1550 to 1631, and they're very united, I think, in what they set about trying to do, both of them. That we've talked a bit about the intentions of the father, towards the MacGregors, and these were kind of replicated in his intentions towards his lordship as a whole. It was all about achieving complete hegemony in the Central Highlands, and he went a long way to achieving that by 1583 when he died, and his son followed in exactly the same mode. So that really does take us through the period of the proscription. And the relationship with the MacGregors, which developed into a full-scale feud in the 1560s involving that young chief who took the path of resistance and was quite successful in some ways in maintaining opposition as long as he did. But he was finally executed, beheaded by his nemesis, Grey Colin, Cailín Lia himself, in 1570. So the and the feud is then healed, you know, the reconciliation is effected, but there was no going back. I think that that decade of outright warfare for much of that decade and outright antagonism, it effectively overrode or really damaged the much longer period of Campbell-MacGregor cooperation that had existed beforehand, and just meant that there was never that same stability to the relationship again. Now that comes through in the time of the prescription. I may be more limited in my knowledge here, but I've got no doubt that you're right in what you say that the prescription takes place at the national level. It's the king himself who enacts this. He's acting, as you rightly say, in the wake of the Battle of Glenfruin. Where the MacGregors defeat the Colquhouns of Luss, who are back in that part of the world, the Lennox, you know, one of the major Lennox clans. And this is one of the last of our major clan battles, you know, a genuine full, you know, kind of head-to-head clan conflict, and one that we've got, you know, really remarkably detailed sources about. You know, one could do quite a thoroughgoing analysis of how this battle played out. But there's no doubt, I think, that we're kind of into an era now, and I think Cailín Lia, Grey Colin is perhaps a harbinger of it too. This is the period, I think, really where the Campbells begin to act in a way which creates that reputation for them, which has now become, I think, the dominant perception that the Campbells were really the hard men of the Highlands, and they were also the kind of the Machiavellians of the Highlands, if you like, you want to put it that way, that they were supremely adept at manipulating others. Your very apt phrase there was the puppet master, and manipulating others through the power that they possessed to do things for them and to take the hit when it came to the how the particular event was perceived. And I think that's a fair way of reading what happens to the MacGregors at Glenfruin. The chief at the time, he was actually the son of the young chief who was placed in this dilemma way back in 1562 and who was executed in 1570. That chief, in his short life, he fathered two sons, both of whom we know something, and his son who succeeded him as chief, Aldus Dubh Ruaidhre, he was MacGregor chief at the time of Glenfruin. And we have a remarkable document left by him, essentially a kind of a confessional document, but a confessional document which seeks to explain exactly what was behind that battle. And he places the finger of blame squarely upon, this is by now the seventh Earl of Argyll. He said that it was the political machinations of that Earl which it was as a result of these that he was persuaded to take the action that he did at Glenfruin. So, and I think this is true of, as I say, of Campbell policy come this point in time, and it's something that we really associate with the Campbells going forwards as well in terms of the way, for example, in which they take the lands of the MacLeans over in the later 17th century. And this is all perhaps pointing us as well in the direction of the well-known massacre of Glencoe in 1692.
Yeah, that's really educational, very informative of how this relationship starts. Probably like the peak of the relationship where they're just really popping and clicking together. Things are really working, both clans are succeeding, and then how it goes south at largely the MacGregor's expense with an extreme example. It was funny because the conversation between Dr. McConaughey and I, we discussed a very, almost for me, it seems like an analogous with the MacLeods of Luas and the Mackenzies. It's a
Yeah.
different story, but there's some really parallel key points, milestones in that story. I think for somebody coming from a Campbell or a McGregor background, I think what you've just shared with us has so much value and is so far beyond what they're going to get on a Google search. So you have helped us out a ton with that. Before we completely wrap it up, what are some key takeaways that you hope that the listeners or the watchers, whatever platform they're doing this on, what do you hope they walk away from this with?
Yeah, well, I suppose a kind of main thing is just to keep your wits about you as you look at these societies, the clan-based society, and not to underestimate or simplify the role of the people within it. I think this is the hardest thing to do as an historian, is to kind of look back and to give, full dignity, respect to those that you look at. Inevitably, we look at them from a kind of a simplified point of view, because the evidence that we have to understand them is limited, and so much time has passed as well. It can be easy in such scenarios to kind of fall back upon kind of big ideas, as it were, and kind of quite reductive ideas, and just to kind of assume that these people are perhaps almost automatons in the way that they behave, that they're kind of dancing to the beat of particular instincts. And that's to kind of reduce their humanity. I think whenever one can get fixes on the sources that allow us to recover stories in detail, the stories of individuals, which we can do with that particular MacGregor chief in the 1560s. We didn't have time to talk about his remarkable relationship with the woman he marries, who is a Campbell, so that kind of cuts against the whole direction of the feud itself. And she's a remarkable figure who has left in her songs, enough evidence to construct her life and her take on the whole thing. And so I think whenever one can do that, kind of recover, the kind of detailed information that allows us to see the human dimension to this, this is really, really precious. It's very attractive as as an historian to stand back and to see the kind of big patterns play out over the centuries. There is truth to be taken from that. And it's fascinating to see for example, the way in which the Campbells grow, and the way in which they do their business changes over time as well, and kind of moves, I think, into perhaps darker, kind of darker realms, of real politique. But beneath that, I think one's always trying to recover the human stories. And I think something that I would really like to do more of in the near future is to concentrate on the woman's side of the story as well, which I think is something that our kind of current understanding of the clans, clan-based society, seriously underplays. So there's great gaps there, but there's also real opportunities as well. So there's a much that's rewarding within the society. I think the other thing, just to finish very quickly, would be to say that naturally, one is drawn to the more spectacular manifestations of what goes on, to the dramatic, and this can lead us within study of a clan-based society to focus on the times when things go wrong, I suppose, basically, and to look at the feuds and the and this, and to th and then to think that this is the nature of the society itself, and that's dangerous. We have to think about what's happening in terms of everyday life, significant periods of peace. The fact that a clan-based society can perfectly stable in the way it operates. There's nothing that says that it should, be predisposed to violence, conflict, I don't think. So I think in almost, there is a need to inject normality, everyday life into our understanding of clan society, and to kind of therefore to tone down the more sensationalist aspects which tend to dominate the narrative as it currently exists.
I love that. I love the idea of it. And it's so hard. Unfortunately, in the historical record, it is these violent conflicts that you don't see the festival or the big all the people in the glen got together for a big party, and you don't or the this clan and that clan, and there's an intermarriage, and they all had a wonderful time, and relationships were strengthened. That doesn't pop up on the historical record. And I love that we have you here to remind us to remember that that was part of life too, and probably more of the norm rather than the exception when violent conflict broke out. That was okay. Thank you so much. Last question for you. Is there Anything that you want to promote, encourage, as far as the projects you have going on? Is there sources? Like, let's pretend that somebody's listening to this and they want to dive into something deeper here. Where can they get more of this?
Well, I'm happy to share some kind of. I can send you some details if you've got means of circulating
I'd love to
references
include them
back
in
to
the
the literature.
notes.
I think one thing actually that occurs to me, Clint, I should have thought of that. But Glasgow University. I'm here at Glasgow, and one thing that colleagues and I at Glasgow did relatively recently, sort of just a few years ago, was to develop a MOOC. That's the acronym, and it means it's a massive online course. It's an online course that one can take, which is about the history of the clans, basically. And that's got some interesting information in it, I think. I mean, I do some talking in that, covering some of the ground that we've talked about today, but other colleagues contribute as well. And it's also good because it's interdisciplinary. We've got colleagues from archaeology talking about that side of things, material culture, if you like, that kind of the more daily, as it were, aspects that we were referring to there. Colleagues from Celtic and Gaelic who are talking about the literary and cultural aspects of Gaelic society, which again helps to, kind of, as it were, normalize our view of the society. So that I believe that a new iteration of that course, that online course, may be becoming available in the near future. So I could share details about that, and it might be a good place to go for some of your viewers if they're wanting to find out more.
Absolutely. If you'll email me a link for that, I'd be happy to
Sure.
post it in the notes for this. So every platform that somebody's consuming this on, a link to that will be right in there. So that'd be
Okay.
wonderful. Okay, so I'm gonna stop recording here in a second. And then I have one more qu personal question right after that. Martin, thank you so much for coming on to this podcast, to this YouTube video. I will be breaking this, I'll publish this as a whole, break it down into smaller, more bite-sized chunks for YouTube. But whatever platform somebody's consuming this on, I think that they are going to get a lot of value. And it has been very enjoyable for me. So thank you so much for your time. And give us a farewell in Gaelic.
Sorry, slán a cheart, I guess I mean the ochas gan de chóirt an cóir, which is to say farewell to you all the best to you, and I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. And it's just to say personally, Clint, many thanks for the invitation again, and it's been a great pleasure. I always really do enjoy trying to share these ideas with a wider audience.
Thank you so much, Dr. McGregor. All right, there it is. There's my discussion. I really, really enjoyed that discussion, and I hope you did too. I hope you found value in it. Once again, if you did find value and you want to contribute to the cause, it's scottish-clans.com/team. But if you are just happy that this is all this stuff, all this awesome stuff is free, then why don't you subscribe or follow or whatever your platform allows you to do? Share it with somebody that you know would be interested in this. There's also more resources you can find over on the webpage, scottish-clans.com. And reach out to me if you have any questions, anything you wish we had dived into a little bit deeper, or an additional insight, something you thought was interesting. I'm always excited to hear from the audience. So I look forward to having you with me on the next episode. Lots of great content to come. And Marishin Leven Drasta.